From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, Senior Lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the Dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Dr. Polyglot Pope.
Polyglot Pope. No one has ever called me that, Dan.
No, you probably only know that word from cramming for the GRE.
So polyglot means I speak many languages?
Yes, you do.
I don't really. No. I speak little smatterings of languages.
So I have had a very conflicted life with foreign languages.
Conflicted?
Yeah. No, I'd being able to speak multiple languages is like one of the most beautiful things in the world. So I took 3 years of French. I don't know why French. I don't know what I was thinking. Finally, I go to Paris, and I'm talking to one of the locals in French, and they put their hand up and say, stop, just speak English.
Oh.
I know. So then when you get a PhD, it used to be that you had to know a foreign language.
In any PhD? So I know in English and in some other subjects, yes. But in education, did you have to – do one for
yeah,
education?
Yeah, back in the day. And
wow.
So, but I was reading this book in French about the history of time. And I'm on like page 40, and there's this one word I can't quite figure out. And I look it up, and I realize I have misinterpreted 40 pages.
Oh, no.
So in the end, I convinced them that knowing how to program the computer counted as a foreign language.
Oh, my
goodness.
And
that's how I got my PhD.
So your programming language got you.
I know a lot. I know a lot of programming.
Okay,
languages.
That's impressive. That's very impressive. So I have a language story. Well, first of all, I am amazed that kids come who don't speak a word of English. So as a volunteer in my daughter's classroom, I would see kids who didn't speak literally like very, very, very little English. This was probably second grade classroom. And then a month later, I'd come back and the kids are speaking. It's really a miracle in my head. And I mean, it's not, because our guest today is going to tell us it's not a miracle. There's a lot of actual science behind it. But that was pretty exciting. And now my cousin teaches in a classroom. So she teaches kindergarten. And half the kids are there who were raised with English as the primary language in their household. And half the kids are there who were not raised with English as the primary language. And she speaks only in Spanish to all of those kids. And I think it's called dual immersion or two-way immersion, but our guest is going to fill us in on all those things. But this is a funny story that she tells. So she speaks only in Spanish. And one day a mom comes, and this mom only speaks English. And so she goes out in the hallway to talk to this mom and they're speaking English. And a kid from the classroom comes out to go to the bathroom. And he hears them, and he looks at her, and his eyes get really big, and his mouth drops, and he goes, you speak English? Like, how did I not know this whole time? And it was this really eye-opening experience. And then I thought, well, is he going to go in and tell everybody else the whole thing has been a charade? You know, she knows how to speak English. But that didn't happen, and they're learning a lot of Spanish in that class, and she loves it.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
I don't know if I remember having discoveries about my teacher's real life. You know,
right.
Like sort of discovering, wow, my teacher has kids.
You know? She's a real person.
Yeah.
So we have a very exciting show today. We have Guadalupe Valdez here, who is the Bonnie Katz Tenenbaum Professor of Education here at the Graduate School of Education at Stanford. And she's interested in a lot of things, particularly she's an expert in how people learn language and how to teach it well. She's also the founding partner of Understanding Language, which is an initiative that focuses attention on the role of language in learning a particular subject, with a special focus on helping English language learners meet the Common Core and the next generation science standards. So she is really an expert, and she's going to help us understand this world, because even the terms keep changing.
Yeah. So welcome, Guadalupe. Thank you very much for
Hello.
Coming. Do give us a primer on the terms, because there's like ELL, ESL, many different, and people get lost.
They do. Probably one of the best ways to start is to kind of back up a bit and look at education and what languages we educate in. typically any nation educates in the societal language. That means the main language that the society uses for its communication. And there's always a challenge when kids come in who do not speak the societal language. And at that point, a society has a couple of choices. And clearly, you could educate only in the societal language. But when you do not speak a societal language and, more importantly, understand it, then it's very hard to learn through that language. So something else societies do is to say, well, we can educate in the language of the children. And that leads us to something that is called bilingual education or mother tongue teaching. You would teach in the mother tongues of those children entering those societies. That's expensive, hard to do, and typically you can't do it in all of the languages.
Right. So I may have a child who comes from a linguistic background that there's only one of those children.
That's right. So that becomes then very difficult. So in some cases, you can set up different kinds of instructional arrangements. And one instructional arrangement might be, we do not have the resources, the textbooks, the teachers that can teach in all of the languages the children are bringing, but we know that we have to bring that English, in the case of the United States where the societal language is English, bringing that English up to speed so that the kids can learn through English. And so there are programs such as ESL programs, English as a Second Language programs, that are called that, and that means that there's going to be instruction in those languages. More recently, people have started using the term ELD, English Language Development, but it's essentially it's the same thing. It's attention being given to the development of language in some way.
Is that because I've also heard ELL?
And that is usually the name given to the children. So an English language learner, ELL, okay, is what that term is used for the learner, him or herself. And the ELL could be in an ESL program or in an ELD program.
And I know that, well, at least the research has shown that there's about 65 different language groups spoken in schools in California. 65. I mean, I think that would just be shocking. It was surprising to me.
That's awesome. There's so many languages.
Right. Is California unique in that sense?
Well, probably not. But I think what sometimes is very important to ask is how many of those do we have, right? And what are the backgrounds of the children that come from those different language backgrounds? For example, here in the Bay Area and all over California, the largest group of speakers are Spanish language speakers, right? Followed by Tagalog and followed by Chinese, right? So you'd really do not have, so those multiple other languages that we all talk about are sprinklings, okay, of those languages. So we cannot actually have materials developed specifically for them in ways that we would for the largest and the most at risk. So you have to combine two things. What is the educational risk? What is the background, the educational background of the parent? The social class of the parents. So that makes a great deal of difference. So it's not just the number of languages. That's the easy way to go. But you're really asking some other questions about what is the vulnerability of those students.
Is it a straightforward empirical question, like which is the best way? Should I have use both languages simultaneously in the class or only use English, only use Spanish? I can't just run the study to decide once and for all?
Well, you know, there have been lots of studies. There have been a number of different approaches to educating individuals who arrive in a society, children who arrive in a society without speaking the societal language. And one of them is mother tongue teaching, right? And so in the United States, mother tongue teaching has been given the name bilingual education. And bilingual education means you're educating in two languages, two media of instructions. And those arrangements could take on any number of forms. You could have mornings only in English, afternoons only in Spanish, this subject in English, this subject in Spanish, or whatever the language is. But what is underlying this is there needs to be access to English, but there also needs to be access to meaning. It's very hard to learn if you don't have access to meaning.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are speaking with Guadalupe Valdez, professor of education at Stanford, talking about how people learn languages, particularly when it's not one that they were raised with in their home.
So the issue that you raised is that I could teach all in English, but because they don't speak English fluently yet, they're not going to get the content.
That's right. And more importantly, they don't understand.
Okay. Right. So it's
really about understanding. If I'm going to explain the concept of number to you, okay, yeah, and you're 5 years old or 6 years old, I want to make sure you get the concept of number. So I have a choice. I can either teach you concept of number in your mother tongue, and then you'll get what I really want you to get, or I can teach it to you, and you won't get it in a language you don't understand.
So that's the key question, right? How do you know they're getting it? And at what point do you say this kid is ready to be with all English speakers or all whatever mother tongue? That's got to be the million-dollar question.
So, you start, you would be designated ELL, and then you would lose that designation? Is that?
At some point in time, you do. So the idea is, and we've set up, most states, because of the accountability issues that we have, they've made sure that students are first of all, identified as being English language learners. There's a lot of conversations around how well we do that. But nevertheless, once identified, that they are followed over time to be able to arrive at some conclusion about when the student is ready then to have all English instruction or needing no support additionally, because support could be either a particularly designed instructional program for you to make certain you're understanding content when you don't have access to be able to teach in those many other languages that we talked about.
All right. I'm a mom, and I've got a kid in a class with a couple of different kids who don't speak English as a first language, and I'm a little worried. I'm a little worried that maybe the teacher is dumbing things down. Maybe it's going a little bit more slowly. How is my kid being affected? I mean, I know it's not really PC to say this. I'm just saying can imagine there would be people who are worried about this.
But there are also those same people are ensuring that their kids are in classrooms where they learn foreign languages.
Right. So we've got two kinds of parents here. What's your advice to both of them, Guadalupe?
Well, amazingly enough, and I think that Dan just talked a little bit about that, that if we realize how much money we spend on teaching foreign languages and how unsuccessful we are, there's Dan. Right?
Who bonjour. Bonjour.
Totally unsuccessful bonjour. When you went to France.
Saba.
I know, right. Où est la ben? See, I took Spanish, but I have basic things I can say.
So what we know is that when the fluent speakers or when the learners outnumber the fluent speakers, that is not a good situation for language acquisition. And most foreign language classes are set up exactly in that way. So for both the children who are coming in that do not speak English, their best context for acquiring English is where there's a lot of speakers of English already. And for anyone who's, say, a mainstream mom that wants to give the gift of language to their children, then you want to have a context in which there's a lot of users of that language around, right? Because they provide affordances for language acquisition.
Right.
So this is huge, because we've been teaching language wrong this whole time, is what you're basically saying. Not just for English, but for learning Spanish as an English speaker, for learning French, for learning Mandarin. We're not putting the right people in those seats.
That's correct.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are speaking with Guadalupe Valdez about the teaching, how people learn language and how to teach different languages well. Really fascinating discussion.
Okay, so as always happens in education, we've now set up the paradox. Any hope?
I think that there really is some hope. I think that as we're beginning to look at, and this is just happening naturally across the world with English, that we're finding that all across the world, all kinds of people are learning English, and they're making use of affordances that they didn't used to before. For example, online courses, games, all sorts of YouTube videos, any number of things. Mm. Realizing that you really need a lot of language around you so that you can acquire the language, right? So the same is true then when we're wanting to educate through a language. We really need to think, if we really don't have the right people in the room, how do you enhance that situation?
Interesting.
So that there will be more access to the language.
So long time ago, there was this guy. He built a shopping mall in Second Life. So Second Life was this virtual world that you could construct, and you'd have your avatar. It was very early. It still exists. And his idea was you would walk through the shopping mall, and you would have with you someone from a foreign country, say Mexico, who would talk to you, and you would have something to talk about, and you'd pay them like $1 an hour. And the idea was you'd have these affordances for conversation as opposed to the placard that shows a bird and you say wazo or whatever. And it was sort of creative. I don't know what became of it. But it was on this idea of how do we set a circumstance where there's affordances for the discussion.
Exactly. And I think that there's a lot of work being done, which I think is very exciting, which moves us into situations where there's a great deal of hope that individual students can be taught how do you self-manage your own acquisition of language.
Oh, right? Interesting.
Right.
So what's the biggest mistake that you see then that happens in these classrooms? I mean, aside from maybe not having the right people in seats, but we have movies and texts, and I know—
That's a good question.
Newspaper. What's the biggest mistake?
No, that's a good question. I like that.
Well, I don't know that I'd want to classify it as mistake. As happens always in education, we are always undergirded by theories of second language acquisition, for example. So depending on how you think that language is acquired, you will do some things. If you think that there's another way that language is acquired, you'll do something else. So there's been a dominant theory that language is an individual cognitive phenomenon and it's acquired inside the head by individuals. But in fact, language isn't that. Language is social. Okay? It's acquired in social interaction, right? So that has been probably the main problem from my perspective, that you really need to have the opportunities to be able to see how the social, how people actually communicate, how the social actually works in communication.
So it means it wasn't my fault in French.
I was just going to say that.
I know you were thinking
I was just going to say, Dan, you're totally off the hook. And that brings up another point to me.
I can still conjugate to be in like five tenses.
Right, but if you can't use it.
No, I can't talk to anybody.
It means nothing. This goes to the point that I hear a lot of world language teachers talking about, which is the importance of culture, of not just learning the language, but also learning the culture. Can you speak to that? Do you think that's an important aspect?
Well, I think if by the culture you mean what is appropriate to say when to whom, right? Because we really need to know that, right? How do you greet people? How do you show that you're available for conversation? What can you say in an elevator to a perfect stranger, right? What is phatic communication? And can you actually start a deep conversation? And you say, nice weather we've been having, or we really needed that rain, right? And that's part of the culture. Again, who speaks what to whom? At what age can you say what? Can you joke with others that are more senior than you? Who do you call by a first name? So all of that is part of language. So that's what people mean when they say the language and the culture are intertwined.
I could see where you could get into a lot of trouble when you don't know the rules and you assume, growing up in the U.S., this is how it works, and you go to another country and you really blow it and you insult someone or get in trouble.
That's correct.
Pretty scary stuff, actually.
I don't know. Don't you think people have some patience on the other side? You're trying to speak their language and you swear by mistake and they go, that's not what we do.
Well, I think there's a little bit of that, but I also think that, you know, this is why the U.S. has a reputation in foreign countries of kind of marching in and assuming that their culture is...
Right. Well, that's because we only speak English.
This is a problem. This is a problem. This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with Guadalupe Valdez talking about how people learn language and particularly how to teach it well next on SiriusXM Insight 121. We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Guadalupe Valdez, a professor of education here at Stanford, interested in how people learn language and how to teach it well.
One argument would be, look, the best thing we can do for these kids is put them in completely immersive classrooms. They're only going to speak English. That's the fastest route to getting them to participate in an English-dominant society. My guess is you disagree with that.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And of course, I disagree for the very reasons we were talking about. What is the best context in which people acquire language, right? And so while we would think that if you have, again, the right people in the room, the ratio is very important, right? So if you actually have 25-1, the only fluent speaker is the teacher and everyone else does not, you're not going to have a lot of English in that classroom. What you're doing in English is all the school stuff, but you don't have any models of English anywhere, right? So it's very hard for that language to develop in ways that you want. And teaching bits and pieces of language can be effective, but it takes a very long time, right? Mm-hmm. So what you want is to be able to have the kids actually get the content and at the same time be growing in their English language proficiency. So most of the recent research, in fact, has persuaded us that when students can be educated in two languages, in two media, that they actually perform better on standardized tests, which is something unexpected. And people have known this now for a while, right?
That is unexpected. You would think somewhere you'd be at a loss, but people are so good at language.
In fact, that's what we find. What you have is an immigrant population that is eager to learn English. There is no one that arrives in this country that says, I don't want to learn English. When English is not acquired, it's because the circumstances are not around. It's immigrants come and they live in the cheapest parts of town, okay, where they can be 17 people in a single one-bedroom apartment. And people that are speakers of English aren't rushing to go have conversations with them in those enclaves, right? So typically the way that people talk about it is saying these immigrants live in these enclaves and they don't want to learn English, but that's not the case. Every one of those individuals is trying to find opportunities to do that, right? So in the schools then, we need to say, how will we give these learners of English access to speakers of English or to any of those other ways of hearing English on a regular basis?
So I lived in an Indian village in Alaska. It was on the Yukon River, and the way it worked is there was an act that allowed church-sponsored activities to get land. And they would take a boat, and they would go into an area, and they would get an outpost. And they might be, say, Methodist or something. And then the next group would come up and get the next town, and they might be Jesuit. One of the things they tried to do was get rid of the native language. And so is that some of the English-only mentality? Is that, no, we're trying to make it so that everybody only speaks English here? Or is that an overstatement?
No, that isn't an overstatement. You know, the idea, when I talked about societal languages, that's a really profound sense of what is appropriate in nation states. And we've had that view of one nation, one language for a very long time. So people have felt that what actually unifies a nation is a single language. Even though we know that people are now all over the world questioning that and saying, no, the communication around the world has to bring us to more than one language only. But because of those old ways of thinking and those old ways of thinking that somehow you weren't loyal to the nation in which you were, if you spoke languages other than the national language, those ideas are still there.
As frustrating as it is, I can see a side that says, well, we need them to vote. We need them to read the materials to be able to vote. We need them to get jobs in workplaces that are primarily English only. And I'm purposely playing devil's advocate.
But it's sort of mistaking this as a zero-sum situation, right? That, oh, if you learn both languages, you don't really learn English.
Right. And I think the more we can show the benefits of knowledge of multiple language is going to be even better. And I think a lot of parents, here in Palo Alto, one of the first slots to fill is the Mandarin two-way immersion program. There are parents of kids who don't speak Mandarin who see the value and know that you want to catch it early, right? That's something that we actually haven't talked about, which is the ease of learning a language as a younger student as opposed to an older student. But they want to put these kids in, particularly at the elementary level, so that they learn it. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, and clearly that is now the view of the gift of language view, but also it picks up on the research on bilingualism, that bilingualism is really an advantage cognitively. Okay, so we find all kinds of cognitive advantages that bilingual children have. Not only can they use them in the world for real kinds of things that they're going to encounter in the world as the world changes, and Chinese certainly makes that case very clearly, but that you actually have a retardation of things like Alzheimer's in bilinguals, where you don't have that in monolinguals. So somehow the bilingual brain isn't like the monolingual brain, and some of us who are bilingual would claim that, of course, we're superior.
Well, Guadalupe, you are. I don't know if it's because you're bilingual, but you are superior.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Guadalupe Valdez about the benefits of knowing multiple languages. I think a lot of people don't know that research.
So there is interesting research coming out about the ability to control attention, to switch between things, because you can imagine if you're code switching in language, you have a lot of control over your cognitive processes as you switch from one network to another.
So that probably does explain the Alzheimer's research.
It's complicated out there. But doesn't like everybody in Europe speak five languages? Aren't we sort of weird the way we are, except for maybe France?
Well, I, Well, I think we haven't been very successful.
I'm bitter about French.
I can tell. It's just, yeah.
So we haven't been very successful in the teaching of non-English languages in this country as subjects. We really haven't. We start too late. We don't have things like language camps, right, the way you have football camps and tennis camps that might encourage people to acquire languages. And we now have some now ideas that we really want to reward those students who actually have had long programs, and they can actually show that they can get some kind of a seal of biliteracy on their diplomas, and that's a movement for good, as opposed to Europe, that for a long time people have just assumed that to be educated means to be bilingual.
Right. Well, that was the intent of the PhD, the language requirement.
And you got around it.
I can program in a lot of languages. So there.
Artificial languages, not natural.
Ooh, it's getting nasty in here. I love it. I love it. Well, I have learned a lot. I have learned the difference in the terms. I will try very hard not to say native language and say societal language. But also, as a parent and community member, I'm going to encourage more people to really sign their kids up to learn these languages. I love the idea of language camp. You have a lot of kids who go overseas junior year of college, but that might be too late, is it?
Well, it's never really too late if you have the will and the interest to do that. And a lot of people arrive at that interest much later in life than others. But of course, all things being equal, the more time you have using a language, the better that it is. The most
hours.
So is it a waste of money to buy one of those tapes or apps that says we can teach you a language in 3 weeks? Do you not buy that?
I wouldn't support that. If you think about language being used for real purposes with real speakers, and that it's a social kind of activity, communicating real meaning, and there may be apps that do that, but those are very few.
It's getting better, where you can talk to your phone and it knows what you're saying and it can translate it and talk back. In that vein, if you look at the biggest sectors that make money in education outside of schools, it is test prep, getting you ready, and it's English language acquisition. This is a lot of money that flows into that, right. And hopefully people figure it out, you know, how to do it, so that it's not hard to get people to learn language for like 30 minutes, but it is thousands of hours, I would think. And how do you get people to do that short of a true social environment, like a camp where you're talking all the time? That's the big challenge, I think.
That's the goal. Pretty exciting. Thank you so much, Guadalupe, for being our guest and for filling us in. And thank you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, you can listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app.